Oh, that worked. That worked. Woohoo! Welcome, party people, to Office Hours on a Saturday afternoon for once. Spitfire, see you in chat. Jim Van Allen, good to see you again with the 17 months of Prime. That's fantastic. Boy, it's been quite a while since I've done one from the office, right? Holy smokes. I've been on the road a whole lot. We did the Miami cruise. I got a cruise to Alaska. And originally, I wasn't even going to do one from the office. I've got another trip coming up. Friends of ours booked an ad hoc trip over to Mexico, just surprisingly out of nowhere. Got really good deals on. I mean, it's probably not a surprise that you get good deals on hotels in Mexico in the peak of the summer. Right now, as I say this, it's 103 degrees Fahrenheit in Las Vegas. There are probably not a lot of people who want to go to hot places during the summer. Vegas tourism totally dives during the summer. You can get into restaurants way easier. I don't want to say it's a nice time of year to come to Vegas. It is not. If you're going to do anything even remotely outside, like you want to go see the Bellagio fountains dancing around or go out to Red Rock, it is hot. Not a real pleasant time to be out and around. Holy cow! Jim Van Allen's is 105 in Southwest Oregon. Wow, that surprises me. Jeez, that is terrible. It does get down in the 90s next week, which is really nice. I'm really looking forward to that. 90s in Las Vegas really isn't bad. 90s in this dry heat out here is really not bad at all, to the point where I do like yard work outside in the 90s and I'm not a strong or a healthy fellow, and yet I still do pretty well out there in the 90 degree heat. Looking forward to the fall and winter for sure. So I thought, well, hey, there are a whole lot of questions have piled up, and there are some good questions. Now, I will say there are also some really short answer questions inside here, but I do like going through y'all's top voted questions. So let's see what the top voted questions are and then go cast our judgment on them. The top voted question comes from Eric M., who says, I've recently become very disenchanted with the commercial SQL Server monitoring tool that I use, and I've been looking at dba-.com. It looks great so far. Do you have any experience or thoughts with it? No, I just because of the weirdo nature of my job, because I have to jump from one company to another all the time, I'm always called into emergency engagements, and I'm not usually allowed to set up big elaborate things ahead of time. Because of that, I don't stay in contact with any of the third-party monitoring tools. I couldn't tell you like if one of them has a big problem right now or if one of them is much better than the others. I just couldn't tell you right now. I can't keep that close of tabs on it. I will tell you, I haven't heard anything negative about DBA-Dash at all. So if you like it, I wouldn't have any reason not to use it. By all means, if it meets your goals. It's also good to, if you do everyone a favor, if you like it, post a review of it. Go to like, whether you start a post on SQLServerCentral.com or MSSQLTips.com, post a review walking through the screens, like blur out your company's confidential stuff, make sure the company's okay with you posting or views or whatever. But if you can, post a review of it to help other people identify it, because especially with open source tools, they don't have any marketing budget, and the more that we can help get the word out, the better. You might ask, well, Brent, why don't you get the word out? Because I don't use those tools. I don't have any production SQL servers of my own that I manage on a long-term basis. I just parachute in and out and do all kinds of emergency stuff. So I'm not qualified to say if it works well long-term or not. Next up, let's see, we have Boris who says, I'm a data warehouse developer and admin. My company wants to give editing access to the risk department to change the SQL code that processes the data warehouse. What should I tell them? Really, you could kind of zoom out and abstract this to anything, to any code and to any team. What's the danger of having someone be able to edit the code? We'll just first make sure that you've got it under source control so that you can see who made changes to it when, and that when people make changes to it, that they have to put in some kind of issue to say, here's the change that I want to make and here's why I want to make it. If you don't have that tracking, then you just have to be honest with management and say, here's what I'm worried about. anyone can go in and break stuff, and I won't have any kind of breadcrumb trail. It's not built into SQL Server to track who changed what code when. It's something that you could build yourself if you want to, but it's just not built into the database. So the thing that I would say to management is if you want to put that in, I'm not going to be able to tell you if anybody breaks anything. And when they do, who's going to be the person who's stuck fixing it? Is it me? God, I hope it's not me. Because if it's me, I wouldn't allow that. Just me, this is what I would say to management, just me personally, you know, and if they go, yep, you're the one who's going to fix it and you're not going to know who changed what when. And I'm going to be like, is that really what you want me to do? Because that's not the job that I signed up for. And I'll keep that job because times are tough right now for me to find another job. But if you see me looking at job ads, don't be surprised. Next up, It's 2025 says, have you found any monitoring tools that work gracefully with PSOP? PSOP.
I think you mean parameter sniffing, parameter sensitive plan optimization. I think you mean PSPO.
No, I have not. But remember, I don't do any work with monitoring tools. Like I just, because of my weirdo job, I can't stay in contact with every monitoring tool and how it does it. What I would do is say, if you've enabled that feature, and it's totally fine if you've enabled that feature, it's cool. But if you've enabled that feature, you're going to have to demo different monitoring tools to figure out what works best with it. Although if you can't type it correctly, you're probably not going to be qualified to do that. Next up, My Tea Got Cold asks, what correct predictions are you most proud of? Oh, wow. I don't track my predictions off the top of my head. I can tell you that from a career perspective, the number one prediction I was the most proud of is the instant that I touched virtualization. Oh my God, it must have been back in like 2003 or something. The instant that I touched virtualization, I was like, this is the future. This is every app server, every database server is going to be virtualized. It is a matter of time. And I bet my career on it in like learning it as much as I could, because I knew it would revolutionize computing. And it did. And that worked out really well for like me personally. So I'd say that's probably one. I don't think you really had to be a rocket surgeon to predict that blockchain wouldn't affect databases, like that it just wouldn't be relevant in terms of database administration or database performance tuning. Today, I'd say AI, if I'm going to make a prediction and like bank on that and be proud of it or whatever, I don't think I could make a prediction about AI that would be correct or incorrect that I would be proud of. Because I think that everybody's making predictions on every side of it. I think what a prediction that you're proud of should be something that goes against popular opinion. Like when I predicted that about virtualization, everyone around me was like, this is idiotic. This will never work for databases. Databases need big metal. No one's ever going to virtualize a serious production SQL server. And I'm like, oh, no, they will. This is coming for everyone. Michael J. Swartz says, hello all, hope everyone's having a great summer. I am, I certainly am. I hope you are as well up there in the great frozen north, Michael. My goodness, my Apple Watch tells me that my current heart rate is 97, which doesn't feel like I'm stressed at all. I will say that whenever you go live, like in front of customers, in meetings, in front of your coworkers, whatever, any time that you're forced to hear the things coming out of your mouth and talk for a long period of time, it is physically exhausting. Like at the end of my day teaching, doesn't matter whether I'm teaching online or whether I'm teaching in person somewhere, it is physically exhausting because your brain is getting all this blood flow from your heart. Your heart goes into the fight or flight response. Now, I've been doing it for a real long time. I'm not scared about it in any way. I'm having a good old time. You know, things can eventually go wrong with it, and then you're really exhausted. But yeah, it's funny how that works. Totally going off topic. Next up, Michael says, a former team member, I like that, a former team member chose to save raw image data in a table. We remove the table column. Should we shrink the database or leave the data file sizes as they are? You always say that shrinking is bad. So for me, just for me, the question is, what percentage of the database is now empty? Then how large is the database? Those would be the two questions I would ask. And there's no clear black and white answer. It's not like I have thresholds somewhere. But if you told me that 90% of the database was empty and it was a 1 terabyte database, then I'm probably concerned, because it's going to be easier to restore a 100 gigabyte database than it is to restore a 1 terabyte database. If you tell me that the database is 50% empty and it's 250 gigabytes, I don't know that I really care that much. I mean, it's just not really that big of an issue for me. Now, but so if you do find yourself in a position where you go, oh my God, it is 90% empty and the file is huge, like it's 1 terabyte, well, yeah, it's a bigger problem. But the other problem is shrinking 900 gigs out of a 1 terabyte file sucks so bad. It's so terribly awful. And takes such a long time that the worse this situation gets, the more likely you are going to be to build a new set of data files. Whenever the database is growing to a significant size, that's usually when I also want to break the files out or a file group in with 4 files in it so that I can evenly distribute some of the workload involved against storage, against tuning storage, things like that. So then you create a new file group, put 4 empty files in it, and you start moving the objects over to the new file group and file. And that can end up being faster because it can be multi-threaded, can be online with Enterprise Edition as well. I'm not saying that it's easy, but it can be less customer impacting than trying to shrink a big, ginormous database. So to recap, I'm not worried about it in most places because the relative size of savings isn't small and nobody's really going to notice it. But in cases where it really matters, shrinking probably isn't the answer anyway. You're going to be migrating over to new files. Next up, Erica asks, my business isn't sophisticated enough for availability groups. How can I achieve high availability in the cloud? Oh, this is such a common question. If your business isn't savvy enough and you're in the cloud, that's what platform as a service is for. Azure SQL DB, Amazon RDS SQL Server, Azure Managed Instances. If you're not savvy, all you have to do is swipe the credit card and Microsoft, Amazon, Google will take care of those things for you. Check out their platform as a service database options. Totally fantastic. That is, I make that architecture recommendation all the time to small businesses who come in because they often say things too like, Brent, your rates are really expensive. You know, here's all we're trying to do. Our database seems, you know, it's big to us, but we know it's small to you in the overall world. And I'm like, just get yourself onto a managed database service where they take care of that kind of thing for you. And then they go, well, Brent, but that's more expensive than if we run our own VM. And I'm like, well, yeah, but I looked at your data. And when you say you run your own VM, you're not running corruption checks. Your backups are only happening once an hour. You got everybody's a sysadmin. You know, come on, you're not really managing that server anyway. Pay a little extra more and the cloud provider will do a better job for you. Next up, Qent says, hi, Brent. I reached a point where I can't get additional value and growth if I keep doing minor repetitive tasks. I have to keep up with these tasks to do my job. Do you follow any work routines like email cutoff times or disconnecting from social media to keep up with deep work? Okay, so you got 2 questions in there. One is, if I have to keep doing repetitive tasks, how do I get that work done? You automate it. This is going to be the story of the rest of your life in IT. You're going to have tasks that you have to do repeatedly, and you're going to want to automate those so that you can move on to higher value tasks. Sometimes people say if you have to do it 3 or 4 times, then you should probably automate it. You should build a script that you're going to run once and step through it interactively. And then as you get more confident with the success of that script, then you're going to build it into something that just runs itself. I also look at it as self-service stuff. Like if customers or end users keep coming to me and asking for the same thing,
I want to build a script so that they can empower themselves and do it themselves. And you might think that that's going to automate your way out of a job, but that's kind of the idea, is that the low-value stuff should go away. You don't want to be famous internally for doing low-value stuff. The second part of your question was, do you follow any work routines like email cutoff times or disconnecting from social media? Well, it is Saturday at 3 p.m., so you can tell that I don't do a great job of cutoffs like that. But as an entrepreneur, as somebody who kind of manages their own business, there's really, it's up to you to when you want to work. What I'll say is I only work so many hours per day. When that time is up, I walk out of this office. I don't close the door because the air conditioning doesn't work all that well here, but I don't close the door, so I want all the air to keep flowing. But I don't go in. I have laptops, but I only use them for the sense of taking a trip. I don't do any work at home outside of this office. Outside of this office in the house is just party time. But yeah, I find it really easy to draw that line. I'll like do emails if I'm walking the dog. If I'm walking a dog around the neighborhood, I might respond to some work emails if they come in. But otherwise, it needs to wait until I'm back in the office. Do I disconnect from social media? Back when Twitter was a bigger thing, I was on Twitter continuously. These days, not. I gave up on Twitter for that guy being just a douchebag. Oslayer Darth says, can we ask you anything? Yes, check out the link up there at the top right there. The top right there is where you post questions and people can vote on your questions, and I'll go through and answer those. But these days with social media, Instagram, I don't cut off. Instagram, I'm on 24/7, like 24, and TikTok, both Instagram and TikTok, I'm on all the time. But like businessy related stuff like LinkedIn or Blue Sky social media, especially since the pandemic, I'm just not as interested in that stuff. I just kind of walk away from that stuff. So I suppose the answer is yes there. Next up, Running Out of Resources asks, we have a historical log table which contains the date and time of the transaction, the username, and an Envercare Max column with some JSON in it. We got 250 million rows and half a terabyte worth of data. What are recommended best practices for reducing storage and increasing query performance? This is one of those open and shut, and I got to get a book, just open and shut. As soon as I read the answer or read the question, I'm like, whoop, case closed. The answer is you get it out of the database. You know what RDBMS stands for? Relational Database Management System. Relational, the very first word in it, the R in RDBMS, relational. If you wouldn't join this table to other objects in a query, it doesn't belong in an RDBMS. I have this discussion all the time with clients. You know, we'll sort their objects by size, and I'll see a table called log events or audit, and it'll be something that's just purely key value. You know, somebody has a key like the user and the date change, and then the object that was changed and all the JSON around it, stuff like that. If it's not joined to something else, get it out of the relational database, put it in a key value store, put it in an auditing platform, put it on the file system, anything like that, because you ain't querying this. You're just asking for individual rows. It's not like you're doing joins there. Let's see. Next up, we have Juan Pablo Gallardo. What a beautiful name. Oh, some names are just utterly gorgeous. That is one. Juan Pablo Gallardo. That's beautiful. Says, is there a specific function to run to make sure that it is okay to reboot the SQL server? Oh, that is also a beautiful question, Juan Pablo. The answer is no. No, there is not. You can check to see what queries are running at any given time. You can do that with things like spblitzwho or spwhoisactive. You can check to see whether or not queries have open transactions, but that kind of thing is left up to you, because for some people are okay rebooting the SQL server if somebody's running a select, for example, or what happens if someone's running an out-of-control query and you just want to kill it and move on with your life. But there is no query to see if it's okay to reboot the server. This is one of the many things
that makes patching SQL Server difficult, and why there aren't a lot of good automated patching solutions out there. They just YOLO their way through patching, just simply rebooting the SQL Server and failing over, calling it a day. It has all kinds of gotchas, as you might expect. Next up, Milosh says, have you ever encountered SQL Server being rolled out and used as primarily an enterprise-ready XML document database? Have I encountered it? Yes. Is it like using a gold-plated toilet? Also, yes. There are a lot of companies out there with more money than sense, and they will do crazy things like use really expensive relational databases as XML filing cabinets, just because that really expensive relational database, they have a team that's comfortable managing it, they have good licensing deals with Microsoft, it's on a standards list somewhere that somebody put out, but is it a good idea? Absolutely not. Milos continues, are there any cautions or precautions for such a use case? No, just don't do it. You don't do that. If you want to do something stupid and expensive, like use a gold-plated toilet, you by all means you can do that, but you won't find any best practices on here are the best ways to put in a gold-plated toilet and keep it clean, because people shouldn't just be doing that. And by the time that they start to do that, they don't really give a damn about best practices. They're already doing something really stupid anyway, so why would we bother writing best practices when they're going to keep doing something really dumb? Brent Ozar Jr. asks, what similarities and differences are there between being a developer or administrator for a transactional database versus an analytical database? What do you do differently between those two? The concepts of how the database engine works is similar, but if you think about how the big differentiator between transactional and analytical is that transactional queries tend to be short and quick, like they're point queries. They're diving in and getting a relatively few number of rows. Insert this shopping cart. Select this shopping cart. Update this order. Show me my orders. Then over on the analytical side, queries tend to be long-ranging and operate over large numbers of rows. They tend to take longer. In analytical systems, analytical systems, people will complain if the query takes 20, 30, 40 seconds. Over on production transactional systems, if something takes 5 seconds, it can often be catastrophic, like bring the site down kind of catastrophic. So those two differences between the two, tiny number of rows versus working on large number of rows, there are different skills in how you work with the people who write those queries. There are different ways that you tune those queries. For example, you could consider using column store indexes in analytical systems, whereas it wouldn't really make sense in transactional systems because you generally don't need them because you're operating on small numbers of rows. So right about now, too, as I explain that, somebody out in comments is going, but we run big reports on our transactional systems, too. I have to do both. Yes, absolutely. You're not the only one out there, delicate flower. There are lots of people who do that. That's how kind of business works there. Next up, Just James says, ChatGPT-5 has read too many of your videos. It seems a bit sassy to me. I wrote a query and asked if it could be improved, and it came back saying there's no window or plus distinct gymnastics. I was using count over partition by. Should I give up my torrid love affair with over partition by? I have no idea without looking at the query. An over partition by, it sounds like a reporting query. You may want to set expectations with ChatGPT around, here are the number of rows in the underlying table. I am writing a reporting query. I am fine with it taking this number of seconds in order to respond. And that'll help it, because otherwise it's going to assume, if you say you want a query to go fast, it's going to assume that you want to operate on as little data as possible. Don't do any big processing gymnastics, but giving it the guidance of how long you're willing to let it take, you just want it to be efficient, we'll probably get less sarcastic answers. It's absolutely true that if you bring me a query that's doing over and partition by on a transactional system, I'm going to be like, hold on, chief. It looks like you're trying to write a big monster report here. You know, what are we doing over in production? Writing big monster reports, those go over against the data warehouse or the reporting server, but they can be completely appropriate over there. Next up, Air Artem says, I'm implementing partition, or when I'm implementing business logic inside or outside the database, when is it appropriate to put it one place or the other, and when is it not? I don't think you're going to find any biblical answers that are really accurate and correct, because people who are database administrators will tell you, don't put business logic in the database if you can avoid it. Don't do processing that's CPU in the database if you can avoid it. That advice comes from the fact that we make a lot of money fixing databases that are doing too much processing. So we're like, don't do that. You know, it's kind of like how if you talk to an emergency room nurse and if you say, what are some hobbies that I should avoid? Emergency room nurses will tell you, do not ride motorcycles. Motorcycle riders are referred to as organ donors because they tend to die young. They will get in accidents. They have good internal organs that are perfectly fine for donating to other people, but they've broken their neck or their arms have been chopped off, whatever, because they went under a semi or whatever. So in a similar vein, if you ask a database administrator where should you put the logic, we would generally say outside of the database. On the other hand, if you ask a developer, someone who's never had to troubleshoot, and I say not that developers don't ever have to troubleshoot this, but if you ask a developer who's never had to deal with too much business logic in a database, you ask them, they will probably say put it in the database because the database tends to be really fast. They just don't connect that it's really fast because we spent a whole lot of money on the database server to make it go fast, and we're trying to avoid spending a whole lot of money. Next up, No Enough DBA says, I'll be moving our SQL Server databases over to Aurora Postgres. Now that you've had started Smart Postgres, have you had any clients make the switch? I have had about half a dozen clients try and fail. This is going to get me in trouble with some of the AWS people out in the audience. I have never seen a successful migration of an existing application from SQL Server over to Postgres where A, the users were happy, and B, it was cost effective. I have seen people throw large amounts of consulting money trying to move an application over. I have also seen applications move over where the people were pissed off afterwards because performance wasn't very good. And I don't say that because Postgres' performance is bad. It's not. But let's think about this for a second. If you take an application and you run its code through a translation layer, and then you run that code on a database engine that has a totally different query planner, different ways of making things go fast, odds are you're going to have some heartache early on. So when people say that they want to do that, that just move the database over and the applications will work, I'm like, make sure you try a proof of concept for that first, because generally speaking, it does not work. Let's see here. Brentozar Jr. again asks, what are some tips for learning on how to become a better data engineer on the SQL side of things? So it depends on what you mean by data engineer. So this is one of those terms that people throw around. Same thing with database administrator. They throw this term around and every person's database administration job is a little bit different. Some data engineers work with Python. Some data engineers work with Microsoft Fabric. Some data engineers only work with Snowflake or Databricks. So you want to find out what's the job that you're aiming for. Like, go out and read job descriptions, assuming that it's a job you don't have today. Go start looking at job descriptions out there and start saying, all right, these are the ones that interest me. These are the ones that do not interest me. If you're trying to figure out how to just become a universal data engineer with without having a kind of a job in mind or a company in mind, it's not really going to work well. You're going to have to learn a jack of all trades, like 1,000 different products, and you're just not going to be successful. Having said that, if you go to YouTube and you search for how to become a data engineer, there are lots of free syllabi,
syllabi, I think is the correct word, that will give you learning plans to become a data engineer using all kinds of free resources. Just keep in mind that they're going to send you down all kinds of different career paths because they'll have you learning all kinds of different topics. You can't be expected to learn all of them before you get a job. Winston asks, when you wake in the early morning, what's your routine and do naps help? I usually get up around 2 or 3 in the morning. I don't use an alarm. That's just when I wake up. I go downstairs, make a cup of coffee. I let the dog out. Then the dog goes back up to sleep with Eve for the rest of the morning. I come in here. I catch up on email. Usually email, social media, blog comments, comments on videos, things like that. Is usually like 2-3 hours worth of work. Believe it or not, I get on average 300 emails a day, so it's pretty time intensive to go through and catch up on all kinds of stuff. Then after those 2-3 hours, the sun has come up. Generally speaking, sun's up here in Vegas, at least in the summertime it is. Then I'll take a break. I'll go out for breakfast. I go out to like McDonald's, Chick-fil-A, Einstein Bagels, whatever. And then when I come back, I shift into a different kind of work. I shift into deep work or I'll work with clients. So like I tend to, unless it's a European client or South African client, I tend to start my clients at like later in the morning, like 7 a.m. or 8 a.m. Start with them Pacific time because a lot of my folks are in Eastern time. Work until noon, take a break, eat, take a nap, and then shift into, again, deep work back in the afternoon. So there you go. But I nap every day, every freaking day, absolutely every day, even when I'm on vacation. Aubrey Plaza asks, for a good decade, when we needed to create a test environment where we used to take a copy of the vanilla version of our database. Now people are mentioning words like version control and Liquibase and telling us to rush into it immediately. In what scenario does this sense make sense to you? In the scenario where people are paying you to do a job. Sometimes executives, they read a magazine or they get a demo from some, you know, fly-by-night company, and they decide that this is the future and they're going to do it. If you are getting paid to do what they say, then generally speaking, it is a good idea to do what they say. What you can do is say, okay, this is cool. This is a new technology I've never used before. Here are the things that concern me about it. I'm going to go ahead and jump in and start working on it. I'll circle back to you after we find out, you know, here were my concerns about it. Let's figure out if we can get past those concerns. And also use those concerns with a vendor too as well. Tell the vendor, here are the things that I'm concerned about. Because whatever concerned you probably concerned all of their other clients, and they may have real quick documentation explaining, here are the ways that we overcome that kind of objection. I say that because I have heard good things about Liquibase. I haven't used it because I'm with you in that usually when I do demo data or development data, we're taking a copy of production and then sometimes even anonymizing it, but often sadly in the real world for rapid prototyping, we're using production data. But if your company is willing to take the hit of having to go build this fake data and source control it, I hear great things about that. So it's just a matter of it's more work. So there you go. And you get paid to do work. Who doesn't want to get paid? And we'll do one more. Let's see here. We'll do one more question. Brent Ozar Jr. is asking questions live, so we'll go ahead and answer that one. It says, what other security concerns do developers and DBAs have to make for SQL databases other than to prevent SQL injection attacks? I could go on and on and on. I actually don't do security work, but if you think about just what's in the databases, who would want it? If you have salary information, people want that. Your competitors would want to know things about your pricing. Your suppliers would love to know things about like how much money you're making. Ransomware people would love to take your data and lock it away from you.
There are so many things that you have to be concerned about, and it all really boils down to making sure that the data is secure and stored in a way that you can recover it quickly. But database security is a huge topic. If you search, Denny Cherry had a book years ago about database security. If you go onto Amazon and search for SQL Server security book, and the author's name was Denny Cherry, just exactly like it sounds. It's old. It's probably 15 years old, maybe. But in terms of the risks to SQL Server, the risks to your business and whatnot, I think it was called Securing SQL Server. In terms of the risks and why we do what we do, that still is all exactly the same. Microsoft used to have a guide for all the security features in SQL Server, and they took that down, and I haven't been able to find it again. It's a shame, because I would love to point you to that as well. All right, we've been going for quite a while there, knocked down a whole bunch of questions. I'll probably erase out the question queue to let that get reset for a new, fresh round of questions. Hope that y'all had fun and learned something, and it's Saturday at 3:30, so I should probably go out and be like a responsible adult and go goof off somewhere, go drive through the desert or something. So I hope y'all had fun, and I will see y'all on the next Office Hours. Adios.